remote thread, that is, a hidden code that executes itself within the address space of an existing legitimate process. Thus hidden, it injected itself under a random file name into the Windows root directory, a file called services.exe, which runs background applications. At this point, the worm owned the computer. It had pulled up a chair in the very core of the operating system, the innermost kernel, what amounted to the system's medulla, which is the lower portion of your brain that regulates autonomous functions like the in-out of your breathing, the opening and closing of the ventricles in your heart, and the contractions of the slippery linings of your intestines. Human beings operate their bodies in the sense that they can will themselves to run a sub-4-minute mile or pull an all-nighter before a chemistry test, but the really important controls, the life-and-death functions, are buried too deep for conscious control. They are safely beyond the reach of clumsy, changeable willpower. The root directory for an operating system is likewise hidden away. Computer operators who inadvertently stumble on it are sternly warned in so many words, "Don't mess with this unless you really know what you are doing." Hassan traced these steps with great care until he was able to find and isolate the remote thread inside his virtual computer and attach it to his own executable file. At that point, he had the worm, in effect, splayed out on his dissection table. He could turn it on and watch it actually go to work. The program's code was deliberately obfuscated, making it more difficult than usual to read, but over several weeks, looking at long strings of ones and zeros, Hassan managed to piece it together. One of the first things he learned was that the botnet being assembled by the worm was scheduled to wake up on November 26th. Whoever launched it had given it 6 days to spread before activation. Because the worm kept track of time by checking with the host computer's clock, Hassan could get an advance look at what it had in store simply by turning his computer's internal clock forward. One of the first things it did surprised him. After performing a few routine moves to initiate itself, disabling the computer's antivirus programs — the infected computer could no longer receive security updates from anti-malware companies — patching the vulnerability at port 445, the smart burglar closes and locks the window he entered, and opening a back door through the computer's firewall to enable it to make an outbound connection from the victimized computer to the botmaster, the worm then checked to see if its new host had a Ukrainian keyboard. That was unusual and revealing. The Internet is global, but law enforcement is not. In many countries, and the Ukraine is one, there is no law against deploying computer scams against people in other countries. So long as cyber thieves do not prey on Ukrainian citizens, they could theoretically empty the bank accounts of every American citizen without breaking the law in their home country. Incidentally, there was a large Ukrainian community in Buenos Aires, where the worm had apparently originated. If the worm discovered a Ukrainian keyboard on the machine, it would not install itself. If it did not, it proceeded. Next, it contacted a website called MaxMind.com and downloaded a Geographic Internet Protocol, GOIP, database. This is what Phil had noted in the original readout on his infections log. The geodata told the worm both where it was and where the computers it sought to infect were. There were at least two reasons why this information might be useful. It could have been yet another way to avoid Ukrainian machines, but it also made the worm's propagation more efficient. Exploiting a buffer overflow is tricky. By knowing where the targeted computer was located, the sender could tailor the message appropriately. Once it established where the infected machine was, once it learned its IP address, the worm contacted the machine's Internet Service Provider, ISP, and began scanning all machines on the same network for vulnerabilities, looking for Windows operating systems to infect. If the machine initially infected was part of a large network, say at a university or military complex, it is likely that none of the other machines on that network were patched, so the worm spread very rapidly within networks. For a machine connected to a commercial Internet provider, the process went more slowly, because there was less uniformity of operating systems on the machines that used that ISP. But once a single machine was infected, every IP address on that network was potentially vulnerable. After it performed these steps, the worm rested. God took a full day. The worm rested for just 30 minutes. It is doubtful at this point that any normal computer user would notice the infection. The worm so limited its use of the host computer's resources and network bandwidth that it barely registered any activity. This was a highly effective method of hiding. So long as the normal functions of the computer seem unchanged, and they would seem unchanged even if slowed by a few microseconds, most computer users would not think to look for an infection. Fussy users who are aware of the normal bandwidth of their machine, the measure of the rate of data exchange, might notice an infection if the rate suddenly increased. This worm was so efficient that its operation registered only slightly on bandwidth monitors, so even users who made a practice of checking the bits per second flow of their machines would be unlikely to notice a significant change. All of this was clever enough, but most of these moves had come before in the world of malware. They marked this worm as state-of-the-art. What Hassan saw next, as he peeled still deeper, really impressed him. Its designers were, in a very real sense, his enemy. But while he might deplore the motives and character of those who unloosed this worm, he could not help admiring their craft. On November 26th, all infected computers would begin checking to see if their host computer was connected to the Internet, and if so, would begin trying to call home. The worm would begin by generating a list of seemingly random Internet domain names, 250 of them, every 3 hours. Every like-infected computer in the world would perform the same trick, spitting out the same 250 addresses every 3 hours until the end of the day. The next day, it would create an entirely new list of 250 domain names. If the host computer was offline, it would check back every minute until it could resume the exercise. The worm-generated domains appeared random, just meaningless strings of numbers and letters, followed by one of five top-level domain TLD indicators, .com, .org, .net, .info, or .biz. But they were, in fact, entirely predictable if you knew the algorithm that produced them. Whoever was controlling the worm needed only to be behind one of those 250 doors to issue a command. Phoning home had always been a botnet's biggest weakness. Worms that created botnets were designed to do four basic things: to break into a computer, to secure it from further security updates, to spread, and to call home for instructions. Without receiving further instructions, the invader was harmless. It carried no instructions of its own beyond installing itself securely. All of the functions, Hassan observed, were designed to settle the invader in safely. And spreading. Once all of the infected computers started calling in for instructions, the worm was vulnerable. If the white hats could find the right domain name of the controller, they could contact a registrar and have it blocked or taken down, and supply law enforcement authorities with the culprit's home office. Effectively, the botnet would be dead. But with 250 new domains being generated every day, this was not going to be an easy task. Whoever had designed this one knew something about how the white hats worked and had planned ahead. In more ways than one. Because if someone figured out which door the botmaster was waiting behind on a given day, this worm was programmed to communicate in code, and not just in any code. Whoever designed it was concerned about more than being thwarted by the good guys. The designers were also worried about competing criminals. A secure botnet was a valuable tool. If a rival botmaster could determine its command and control site and issue his own instructions, he could effectively steal it. So the new worm took no chances. It employed the most advanced public encryption method in existence to protect its communications. Breaking codes used to be the province of clever puzzle masters who, during World War II, devised encryption and code-breaking methods so difficult that operators needed machines to do the work. Computers today can perform so many calculations so fast that, theoretically, there is no longer any such thing as an unbreakable code. One applies what computer scientists call brute force, trying every possible combination systematically until the secret is revealed. Such an approach would take human beings thousands of years if the code was sufficiently complex, but it would take a modern computer only a few seconds. The encryption game today is about making a cipher so difficult that the amount of brute force required to break it renders the effort pointless or too expensive. The thief would have to spend more to obtain the prize than the prize is worth. In his 1999 history of code making and breaking, The Code Book, Simon Singh wrote, "It is now routine to encrypt a message so securely that all the computers on the planet would need longer than the age of the universe to break the cipher." It is one thing to write a code that only its controller can decipher, but quite another to devise a method for two parties to communicate in code in public. Public encryption is essential for, among other things, e-commerce, where customers send private information over the Internet. The basis for the highest level is a public encryption method invented in 1977 by three researchers at MIT. Ron Rivest, the primary author, Israeli cryptographer Adi Shamir, and Leonard Adelman of the University of Southern California. In the more than 30 years since it was devised, the method has been improved several times. The National Institute of Standards and Technology sets the Federal Information Processing Standard, which defines the cryptography algorithms that government agencies must use to protect communications. It is also the basis for nearly all high-level encryption that allows private transactions over the Internet. The American standard is determined by an international competition among the world's top cryptologists, and since this is the highest-level contest of its kind, the winning entry becomes the world's standard by default. The current high-level standard is labeled Secure Hash Algorithm-2, SHA-2. The Worm used three crypto algorithms. It utilized Rivest Cipher 4, RC4, to encrypt its binary messages. SHA-512, one of the family of high-level standards that use 512-bit words, to ensure that even if someone broke the RC4 cipher, the intruder would not be able to alter the message, because the algorithm would detect a single bit modification in a trillion-bit stream. And RSA, Rivest Shamir Adelman, a signature system that guaranteed messages from the Worm's controller were authentic. The use of RSA meant that both the Worm and the Botmaster possessed two keys, a 1,024-bit public key and a 1,024-bit private key. The Worm's keys were different from the Botmaster's keys. In order to break the code, you needed both. The Worm sent its message encrypted with the Botmaster's public key, and he could decrypt it with his private key. A return message would be encrypted with the Worm's public key, but could be decrypted only with its private one. It was theoretically possible to divine the private key from the public key, but only with one of the most powerful computers in the world, like, say, the ones available to the National Security Agency, NSA, or the Defense Department. Even if Phil and his team succeeded in intercepting a message from the Botmaster, they would not be able to decode it. This meant the Worm's author, or authors, were fluent at the highest levels of cryptography. As exceptional as this step was, Hassan had seen it before. It did show an unusual degree of care. These people were clever, he thought. They had designed this with a checklist in mind. They had done their homework. They were not just creating a remarkable illicit asset. They were determined to protect it, keeping one step ahead of whoever might compromise it. That was impressive. But the next thing Hassan saw as he peeled deeper into the Worm really surprised him. He had never seen it before. On the HTTP query line for each generated web address, each of those random domain names it generated daily was a number that at first he did not comprehend. He shelved the question for a few weeks as he worked out how to dial the domain-generating algorithm, DGA, forward, generating a daily calendar of the websites the worm would be trying to contact. But when he had finished with that, he returned to the number. He finally determined that it recorded the number of machines the worm had infected from that bot. He saw immediately why that would be useful. The worm was randomly infecting any machine it could infect, but some computers were more interconnected than others. Most of us live and work within a relatively small circle of people, so our computers interact with only a small number of others. But some people, and hence some computers, are what social network theorists call nodes. They are widely connected. They tend to be on the internet full time. They exchange information with an extraordinarily large number of others. The mystery number on the HTTP line informed the botmaster which computers on its net were the most widely connected and the most valuable. This meant that if the White Hats succeeded in shutting the botnet down, its creators would not have to start over with random infections. They could begin by targeting the nodes, which would propagate the worm much more efficiently and quickly. That, thought Hassan, was really, really clever. These guys were creating this botnet to last. The new worm was to do something else on November 26th. It was programmed to contact a notorious malware distributor called TrafficConverter.biz. This site offered affiliates cash for steering suckers its way. Each unsuspecting computer owner conned into linking with the site began receiving bogus warnings of infection on his screen that directed him to download antivirus software, which sold for anywhere from $50 to $75. The real infection, of course, was the Traffic Converter's program, which blocked the computer user from contacting legitimate antivirus companies and would continually pester the user until he paid the fee. The site's operators offered prizes for affiliates who brought in the most business, including a Lexus sports sedan. Huge amounts of money were made this way, both by the owners of TrafficConverter.biz and by its affiliates, who were raking in as much as $3.9 million a year, according to a report by cybersecurity reporter Brian Krebs. But 2 days before the new worm was scheduled to steer its botnet to the scam, TrafficConverter.biz was taken down. Major credit card companies had suspended payment operations for the site, effectively putting it out of business. This turned out to be best for all concerned, including TrafficConverter.biz, because when the worm kicked in, it steered 83 million inquiries to the site from 179,000 unique IP addresses. This would have crashed the site if it had been open for business. At first glance, the connection with TrafficConverter.biz suggested a lead to the worm's authors. About a month before the worm appeared, another notorious malware distributor, Baca Software, had sponsored a contest. It offered a new car to whoever could infect the most computers. Baca was responsible for a scam called Antivirus XP, and, as it happens, this was likely to have been the product downloaded by computers that contacted TrafficConverter.biz. The company also has a registered office in Kiev. The connection suggested that the new worm's designers might have been trying to win the contest. If the website had not been taken down, the worm would have steered an unprecedented flood of business its way. Too much, as it happened. But there were other possibilities. Since the traffic generated by the new worm would have crashed the site, might it have been designed by TrafficConverter.biz's competition? Or were the new worm's creators toying with the White Hats, creating a false trail, much as they had done with the packaging of the worm itself? Why not cover their tracks further by drawing everyone's attention to a known malware distributor who was, in this case, innocent? Whatever its purpose, the link to TrafficConverter.biz gave the worm a name. Some labs had been calling it Down Add Up or Kiddo, but Microsoft security programmers shuffled the letters of Traffic Converter and came up with Conficker. Ficken is the German word for fuck. Blend that with English syntax and you get Ficker, which this worm was, without a doubt. The name stuck. By December 1st, Conficker had burrowed into an estimated 500,000 computers worldwide and was knocking out 250 new domains every day looking for instructions. It was just getting started. 4. An Ocean of Suckers. Having mutant powers doesn't give us the right to dominate others. The X-Men Chronicles. The idea of an infectious computer worm is lifted from the pages of science fiction. More than a decade before the Internet was born, the British sci-fi writer John Brunner invented the idea of a viral code that could invade and sabotage it in his 1975 novel, The Shockwave Rider. With startling foresight at a time when Bill Gates was taking a leave of absence from Harvard to co-found Microsoft, Brunner imagined a dystopian 21st century world wired into a global data net controlled by a malicious state. His hero, a gifted hacker named Nick Haflinger, creates a program he calls a tapeworm that can infiltrate the data net, spread on its own, and ultimately subvert the government. "My newest, my masterpiece, breeds by itself," he boasts. In Haflinger's case, much as with the creators of WikiLeaks, the data net is directed to break into government files and spill state secrets. Brunner chose to call his techno-weapon a tapeworm because the code, like the creature, consisted of a head attached to a string of segments that were each capable of regenerating the whole. "What I turned loose in the net yesterday was the father and mother of all tapeworms. It can't be killed," he says. "It's indefinitely self-perpetuating so long as the net exists. Incidentally, though, it won't expand to indefinite size and clog the net for other use. It has built-in limits. Though I say so myself, it's a neat bit of work." Brunner's ideas about the coming digital world were clever, but as a prophet, he was strictly derivative. His vision was of a piece with those of George Orwell, Aldous Huxley, Philip K. Dick, and others who foresaw the totalitarian movements of the 20th century as portents of a dark future where all power would be concentrated in the hands of an oppressive state. Each of these writers predicted that technology would be an important tool of state oppression. For Orwell, it was TV. For Huxley, it was psychotropic drugs. For Dick, it was both of the above combined with bioengineering. For Brunner, it was the computer, or more correctly, computer networks. The ideas in The Shockwave Rider, particularly those about the coming age of digital interconnection, were largely based on futurist Alvin Toffler's book, Future Shock. They were so prescient that computer programmers recalled the tapeworm a few years later, when they began devising the first real worms in research labs. The fears Orwell, Huxley, Dick, and Brunner vividly articulated in their fiction still have adherence and have inspired some striking and successful Hollywood films, but so far they have not panned out, certainly not in the case of computer networks. The structure of the Internet, or lack of structure, has worked against centralized state control. The thing has a billion heads. It is defiantly ground up. Since it has become a factor in world events, governments everywhere have found it harder to keep secrets and to escape the public's gaze. The data net has proved so far to be a tool less of oppression than of liberation. And the architects of worms and viruses aren't the heroic rebels battling state tyranny imagined by Brunner, but nihilists and common criminals. In the mid-1970s, the only large computer networks that existed were at university, business, or government centers. Many of the young computer geeks who would create the Internet age, and in some cases amass great fortunes, first stumbled into the larger potential for such networks by borrowing processing time, with or without permission, to play games or show off their hacking skills. Gates and Allen used the computer provided to privileged students at Lakeside Prep, and when they outgrew it, they persuaded the school to lease time for them on an outside one. There were few barriers to access, because computing power and connectivity were seen as entirely beneficial. Openness was essential to the movement's appeal. The first sour notes in this techno-Eden were simple devilry. The early computer networks were plagued by savvy outlaws, cyberpunks, who used their knowledge of operating systems to play pranks, to write juvenile slogans across the monitors of compromised computers, the way graffiti artists scrawl their initials on urban walls. There was a playful quality to such efforts, undertaken often just to show off the hacker's skill. The term was not entirely derogatory. Hackers took some pride in the designation and had fans. Most of what they did was harmless. To this day, the grungy, long-haired geek living in his parents' basement, fueled by pizza, soda, and junk food, the picture first painted by Weizenbaum, has become a cliché in Hollywood, bedeviling the powerful with his antisocial genius, thwarting malevolent syndicates, running rings around the official experts. These pioneer miscreants came to symbolize the anarchic spirit of the Internet movement, the maverick genius at war with the establishment. But as the Internet has rapidly evolved, so have its predators. The newness of computer networks and their global nature posed novel problems for law enforcement. In many jurisdictions, preying on people in cyberspace is not officially criminal, and often in places where it is, there is little urgency in prosecuting it. In his 1989 bestseller, The Cuckoo's Egg, Cliff Stoll told the story of his stubborn, virtually single-handed hunt for an elusive hacker in Germany who was sneaking around inside Stoll's computer network at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and using it as a backdoor to U.S. Defense Department computers. The subject was hunted down, but never prosecuted, in part because there were no clear laws against such behavior. For many people, the cuckoo's egg introduced the netherworld of gamesmanship that still defines computer security. Stoll's hacker never penetrated the most secret corners of the national security net, and even relatively serious breaches like the one Stoll described were still more of a nuisance than a threat. A group calling itself the Legion of Doom had a good run in the 1990s, invading computer networks and showing off while not doing much damage. The group published a technical newsletter to advertise its exploits, and members gave themselves colorful comic book-style monikers. There were other hacker groups like it, including the New York-based Masters of Deception. Some members of these clubs were hauled in and prosecuted by federal authorities in the 1990s, considerably upping the price of such stunts. Little of the old glamour still attaches itself to serious hackers. The game has evolved into something far bigger, smarter, and more menacing. Real trouble arrived with the big DDoS, distributed denial-of-service attacks of the 1990s, which aimed tidal waves of service requests at certain websites. Instead of showcasing the skill of a hacker, the purpose of a DDoS attack was wholly malicious, sometimes political, often vengeful. A DDoS attack capitalizes on the openness of Internet traffic to simply overwhelm the capacity of an organization to respond. Those orchestrating such attacks employed computer networks to automatically generate request after request, multiple times per second, until they brought to a halt the servers for credit card companies, banks, the White House, government agencies, the Holocaust Historical Museum, political parties, universities, and any other vulnerable website that was deemed offensive. The worst DDoS attack came on October 21, 2002, when the Internet's 13 root servers were hit simultaneously. This was clearly an effort to bring down not just individual websites, but the Internet itself. The root servers survived the hour-long assault, but only barely. It forced such root servers to invest in heavily redundant stores of memory enough to absorb massive potential attacks. This event was important. It was a sobering demonstration for those paying attention, which is to say, the tribe. This was a very small select group of people. The vast majority of Internet users remained oblivious. So long as Google and YouTube and Facebook kept humming along, everyone else was happy. By the 21st century, the Internet was a given. It was there on your phone, in your car, on your iPad. It was everywhere through either a Wi-Fi or a phone connection. There were myths about its invulnerability. It could not be shut down because it lacked any kind of central control or routing system, or so the story went. And there was some truth to that belief. The way the Internet routed information was entirely new, an advance over all previous communications systems, and one that was inherently sturdier. Finding your way on the Internet isn't as direct as, say, routing a telephone call. Telephone lines carry the electrical impulses of an outgoing call along wires down the shortest available path to the number being called. The big difference between the Internet and telephone networks, or the interstate highway system for that matter, is that traffic does not flow down clearly defined, predictable pathways. There are detailed printed maps of telephone networks and highways, and the paths taken by calls and vehicles can always be clearly traced. One of the major conceptual breakthroughs that enabled the creation of the Internet was to do away with this clarity. The idea was called packet switching. The concept apparently came almost simultaneously to two Cold War scientists, Donald Davies, working at Britain's National Physical Laboratory, and an American immigrant scientist from Poland named Paul Barron at the Rand Corporation in the late 1960s. Both researchers were trying to invent a new, more robust communications network. Barron was specifically tasked with designing one that might withstand a nuclear attack. Davies was just looking for an improvement over the existing telephone switching networks, but there is little doubt that the experience of prolonged German aerial bombardment during World War II lurked somewhere in the back of his mind. Traditional phone networks had critical trunk lines and central switching stations that, if destroyed, could effectively short-circuit the entire network. Both Barron and Davies wanted a system that could survive such blows, that could not be taken out. The alternative that seemed to work best was modeled after the human brain. Neurologists knew that after severe head injuries, the brain began to power up alternative neural pathways that avoided areas of damaged or destroyed cells. Often patients completely recovered functions that, at first glance, might have seemed hopelessly lost. The brain seemed to possess enough built-in redundancy to compensate for even seemingly catastrophic blows. Abandoning the most direct pathway would not have worked for telephone grids, because the farther the message traveled through the network's wires and switches, and the more times its direction shifted, the more degraded the signal became. Digital messages, on the other hand, messages composed in the ones and zeros of computer object code, never degraded. They could bounce around indefinitely without losing their integrity and still arrive pristine. There was another advantage to the digital approach. Since messages were broken down by the computer into long lists of ones and zeros, why not break them down into smaller bits, or packets, and then reassemble them at the endpoint? That way, even a message as simple as an email might take dozens of different pathways to its destination. It was more like teleportation than simple transmission. You disassembled the data into many distinct packets, cast them out on the network where each packet found its own way, and then reassembled the data at the endpoint, all in microseconds, which are perceived by humans as real time. No delay. Diagrams of the proposed packet-switching network looked more like drawings of interlinked brain cells than a roadmap or a telephone grid. Such a network required minimal central planning because each new computer node that connected just enlarged and strengthened the web. You could not destroy such a network easily because even if you managed to take out a large chunk, traffic would automatically seek out surviving nodes. This gave the Internet an especially hardy nature, a fact that buttressed the anarchic theology of the techno-utopians. But it was not invulnerable, as the massive 2002 DDoS attack demonstrated. The system's root servers were critical, because all Internet traffic relied on at least one of the 13. If you could mount a sufficiently powerful assault, it was theoretically possible to overwhelm all 13 and bring even this very resilient global network to a dead stop. It would take a mighty computer to mount an attack like that, or one very, very large botnet. By the turn of the century, botnets were the coming thing. and they were getting easier to make. In the beginning, networks were created by wiring computers together manually. But as the infrastructure of the Internet solidified, interconnection was a given. Almost all computers today are connected to a network, even if only to their local ISP. So if you were clever enough to make all the computers on a network work together, you could effectively assemble yourself a supercomputer. There was even a poorly guarded infrastructure already in place to facilitate such work. Techies had long been using Internet Relay Chat, IRC channels to maintain constant real-time dialogue with colleagues all over the world. IRC offered a platform for global communication that was controlled from a single point, the channel's manager, and was used to host open-ended professional discussions, laboratory projects, and teleconferences before desktop applications for such things became widely known or available. Members of a group could use the channel to communicate directly and privately to one another, but could also broadcast messages to the entire membership. Some of the earliest benign bots were crafted by IRC channel controllers to automatically monitor or manage discussion. The idea wasn't completely new. Computer operators had long written programs to automate routine tasks on their networks. These early bots were useful and harmless. In the late 1970s, a Massachusetts researcher named Bob Thomas created a silly worm he called Creeper, which would display a message on infected machines. "I'm the Creeper, catch me if you can." Creeper was more frog than worm. It hopscotched from target to target, removing itself from each computer as it jumped to the next. It was designed just to show off a little and to make people laugh. But even those engaged in noble pursuits sometimes don't play nice. Chat room members sometimes chose to commandeer these channels to, in effect, become alternate controllers. One very effective way to hijack an IRC channel, to, in effect, create a botnet, was to bypass individual computer operators with a worm that could infect all the machines. The author seeded the network with his code and linked them to himself. The official manager of the channel would have no idea his network had been hijacked. The usurper could then marshal the power of the network to mount a DDoS attack against those with whom he disagreed or of whom he disapproved. Or he could simply explore the network all he wished, collecting information from individual computers, spying, or issuing commands of his own. It was a tool ready-made for more nefarious purposes. On Wednesday, November 4th, 1988, as voters went to the polls nationwide to choose Vice President George H.W. Bush over Governor Michael Dukakis of Massachusetts for the White House, a headline in the New York Times read, "Virus in Military Computers Disrupts Systems Nationwide." The writer, John Markoff, reported, "In an intrusion that raises questions about the vulnerability of the nation's computers, a Department of Defense network has been disrupted since Wednesday by a rapidly spreading virus program apparently introduced by a computer science student. By late yesterday afternoon, computer experts were calling the virus the largest assault ever on the nation's computers. The big issue is that a relatively benign software program can virtually bring our computing community to its knees and keep it there for some time," said Chuck Cole, Deputy Computer Security Manager at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in Livermore, California, one of the sites affected by the intrusion. "The cost is going to be staggering." For those inclined to conspiracy theories, it was noted with particular interest that the 23-year-old author of the virus, Robert Tappan Morris, a Cornell University graduate student, was the son of the chief scientist at the National Computer Security Center, a division of the National Security Agency. The younger Morris had grown up playing with computers. Typical of those in the hacking community, he had a fluency with networks and network security, such as it existed at that time, which is to say, nearly always not at all. By all accounts, he cooked up the worm on his own. Markoff reported that the grad student's creation had clogged computer networks nationwide. In 1988, these networks still mostly belonged to the military, corporations, and universities. Cliff Stoll, then working as a computer security expert at Harvard University, told the newspaper, "There is not one system manager who is not tearing his hair out. It is causing enormous headaches." The managers were annoyed, certainly, but also clearly impressed. More than one programmer described the Morris worm as elegant. It consisted of only 99 lines of code and had a number of clever ways to invade computers, one of them by causing a buffer overflow. Remember that technique? In a file-sharing application of the ARPANET. Morris launched his worm from an IP address at Harvard University to cover his tracks at Cornell, expecting it to evade detection in the computers it infected. As smart as it was, the worm had a fatal flaw. In an effort to protect itself from being flushed out of a network, the code was designed to reproduce itself wantonly, and much to Morris's dismay, ended up spiraling out of control. When he realized that it was running amok, he said he tried to send out instructions to kill it, but the networks were so jammed with his worm's traffic that the corrective could not get out. Once it malfunctioned, Morris never tried to evade responsibility. He was later convicted under a new Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, fined $10,000, and sentenced to 3 years of probation and 400 hours of community service. Perhaps a more lasting punishment has been lifelong notoriety, a quasi-hero status among those who admire acts of cyber vandalism. He is today an associate professor at MIT, and insists he had intended nothing more than to quietly infect computers in order to count them. Prosecutors charged that he had, in fact, designed the worm to attack computers owned by Sun Microsystems Incorporated and the Digital Equipment Corporation, two of the institution's hardest hit. Prior to this stunning event, some in the tech field had differentiated between viruses and worms by classifying the former as malicious, the latter as beneficial. On purpose or not, Morris's worm confirmed its destructive potential. Jeffrey Goodfellow, president of Anterior Technology Incorporated, told Markoff, "It was an accident waiting to happen. We deserved it. We needed something like this to bring us to our senses. We have not been paying too much attention to protecting ourselves." This kind of lament was becoming common, and we would hear it again. As the Internet began to more fully congeal in the following decade, and as the personal computer became as commonplace in American homes as the TV set, malware preyed primarily on the explosive success of email. Having learned to invade computers and propagate over networks, malware creators were no longer content to demonstrate their ability to infect and spread. They were now intent on writing malware that could actually accomplish something. Making computers easy to use and linking them together had many wonderful effects, but it also created an ocean of suckers. Worms and viruses exploited the naivete of new computer users, who readily fell victim to Trojan horses, usually emails enticing them to open unsolicited attachments. One of the worst was the Melissa virus, so dubbed because its author, David L. Smith, admired a lap dancer by that name. It was inadvertently released from a sexually oriented website and was designed initially to distribute pornographic images. It worked by attaching itself to a Microsoft Word document, and once downloaded by a single user, would raid email files for new targets and begin mass mailing itself. Melissa rapidly clogged networks worldwide. Smith was arrested, served 20 months in prison, and was fined $5,000. The email attachment technique is still used today, but peaked with the I Love You virus in 2000, which arrived as a mysterious email with a compelling come on, I love you, and invited recipients to open the attached missive from an unknown admirer. It preyed on curiosity, loneliness, and vanity, and once invited into a computer, like Melissa, sought out email files for new targets. This virus, designed by two programming students in the Philippines, was crafted to steal passwords from victims' personal files, but failed, so it fell more into the category of malicious mischief than theft. it resulted in an estimated $5.5 billion in damage, infecting as many as 50 million computers in a single day. Like the malware to come, it exploited a known vulnerability in Microsoft's operating system. It was the attack that prompted the software giant to get serious about protecting itself, and came, coincidentally, at precisely the time when Microsoft was hiring TJ Campana. The success of these email viruses made computer users more wary about opening unsolicited attachments and helped create the lucrative antivirus industry. Melissa and I Love You gave way to what Phil Porras calls the era of the massive worms. There would continue to be very successful email viruses, notably one named after tennis star Anna Kournikova, which took advantage of her fetching image to lure computer users into opening a picture, but heightened security measures and pickier computer users gradually forced greater stealth. Worms needed no human help. One of the first big ones was Code Red, which appeared on July 13, 2001, and was so called because the researchers who discovered it happened to be drinking a soda by that name. It created a buffer overflow in Windows operating systems by generating long strings of the letter N, thereby overflowing the buffer and hijacking the storing program. It defaced websites by displaying the triumphant message, "Hello, welcome to http://www.worm.com, hacked by Chinese." It was soon so widespread that the phrase "hacked by Chinese" entered the language, appropriated by victorious online game players to lord it over defeated opponents. The author of Code Red was never caught, but most clues again pointed to the Philippines. It was thought to have infected 359,000 computers. Code Red was followed by a succession of worms, Slammer, Blaster, Nimda, Sasser, and others, which increasingly focused on vulnerabilities Microsoft had already patched. But the era of the massive worms effectively ended when the software giant released Service Pack 2 in 2004, buttoning up the operating system as never before. It marked the end of the naive early period of Internet development, which was defined by the happy notion that freely sharing all information would save the world. This belief still has its fierce adherents. WikiLeaks comes to mind. But the average computer user had learned his lesson by 2004. Microsoft, at least, had noticed snakes in the garden. Whereas Windows initially had been designed to have a strictly hospitable disposition, happily opening whatever packet of data came knocking, Service Pack 2 regarded anything inbound as a threat. At the same time as the legitimate computer world was wising up, so was its evil counterpart. Malware in the first decade of the 21st century underwent something akin to the Cambrian explosion, a period in evolutionary history when change seemed to accelerate. The key was the shift from malware as vandalism to malware for profit. Up until that point, those malefactors inept or unlucky enough to get caught were all what today's security experts call script kiddies, amateurs who borrowed software written by others and attempted to employ it for their own ends. They had appropriated malware themselves that could spread and make some sort of goofy display. But there remained a big stumbling block to actually using these rapid spreaders to do something useful, specifically to make money. The next step was foreseeable. Profit is the universal trigger of innovation. At a malware conference in Washington, D.C. in October 2003, Stuart E. Schechter and Michael D. Smith, professors at Harvard's School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, noted that the opportunity was ripe for a new class of malware, one that they called an access-for-sale worm. An access-for-sale worm enables an individual to control a large number of systems and sell access to each one to the highest bidder, they wrote. It enables the black hat community to work together to pool their skills and distribute risk in order to maximize the loot they extract. Loot being money potentially drained from bank accounts or valuable credit information. They predicted that the new worm would close the door through which it entered a system and repair the vulnerability to prevent copycat worms from gaining access to the system. It would open a back door to invite privileged access to the botnet controller and would report back information about the kind, value, and specific vulnerabilities of each system it invaded. Once such a botnet was created, control could be maintained with well-known public encryption methods. So long as the worm's creator restricted direct communication to an occasional update, he could set himself up as a middleman, providing the actual thief with a mechanism to steal while shielding himself from risk. Clients could select infected networks vulnerable to their specific criminal attempt and even make test runs before renting the platform. Such an approach would combine the reach of a massive worm infection with the control of a small targeted hack. "Few of the worms released today are written for the financial benefit of the author," they wrote. "If the attacker wants to target a specific system, he will find it more effective to attack it directly or via a Trojan horse than to wait for a virus or a worm to propagate to it. If a worm's author attempts to trace the propagation of his creation through a network, he risks detection through traffic analysis. Even if he can successfully track propagation, he may not know the value of the systems he now had access to. These problems do not trouble the creator of an access-for-sale worm, as he need not seek out the infected systems or know how to best profit from a targeted attack on them. Instead, he provides others with the ability to covertly detect whether machines are infected and offers to sell them the opportunity of gaining access to those systems. Along with the opportunity, the seller also transfers to the buyer the risks that come from such an intrusion." And so it was. The enterprise migrated to organized crime and to nation states. A new industry sprang up, primarily in Asia and Eastern Europe, a nemesis for the emerging computer security industry. This was not something even on the radar of the techno-utopians. For every antivirus company like Symantec, there was now a dark Symantec, a bizarro world equivalent, bent on exploitation, filled with comparable experts and profitable enough to sustain research and development. Today, there is big money for those who can stealthily invade computer networks or construct a secure botnet, and no modern military arsenal is complete without state-of-the-art malware. The worm, credited or blamed for pushing the game from pranksterism to profit, was Bagel, which appeared in 2004 as an email attachment and is still very much alive. It assembled about 200,000 computers into a botnet that still generates an estimated 5.7 billion spam messages daily. Bagel's innovation was to open a backdoor to Microsoft's Transmission Control Protocol, one of the most basic functions of the operating system that governs data exchange. A backdoor is a way of transferring data that avoids the computer's firewall by having the infected computer invite intrusion. It allows the botnet's controller to raid any data stored on the host. Bagel also blocked communication with antivirus sites, which prevented infected machines from being cleaned or updated, and it delivered in the text of the code a boastful poem for its enemies.